Let's do this thing.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Nerdy Times. This is Corey. With me always is Dan.
Hello. And no Joe.
And no Joe today. Segment producer Joe is working on his home.
He's in the box.
He's in the box. Mom and Dad are making him do some work, I guess.
Shut up.
Yeah, that's right. Back in the box, Gimp. But today, we're going to bring you some more stuff that we had from Contamination. You're hearing one today. One of the is the first interview that I actually did there. It was kind of when I do these things, I kind of go around and I just talk to the different actors and stuff initially and see if they're interested, and so I can kind of get my my way, you know, figure out how my evening is going to go. And I stopped by this guy's table, Larry Bishop. He's been in a number of different films, and he's a director and just an amazing actor and guy. And I walked up, and he's just kind of standing there, and he's looking kind of like anxious, like he wants to do something. He's just, you know, he just was kind of, you know, he just didn't want to sit around. So I walked by and I said hello and introduced myself, and he's like, yeah. And I said, would you be interested in an interview? He goes, let's do it now. And I'm like, all right, let's go. And so we sat down and talked, and he was a really great guy, just a heck of a lot of fun. And it's somebody that I honestly am not overwhelmingly familiar with all of his work. I know some of it, but, you know, I had no
idea.
What
was he in?
Huh?
Some of his work.
He was
in... Did I ask a difficult
question? No, he was in Kill Bill and Hell Ride.
Oh, yeah, okay,
and,
okay.
You know, just a, you know, he's just been in a lot of different things that, you know, and he's directed a lot of very famous people, and it's just, it just blew my mind that I wasn't aware of that, you know, that... But I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to let him talk about it. Here's my interview with Mr. Larry Bishop. Hello, everybody. This is Corey, and I'm here with Mr. Larry Bishop. Welcome to the program.
For the audience, this is take two. Corey's recorder wasn't worried. This is take number two, which I'm willing to do. I'm willing to do because he's my first interview. He's my first and second interview now.
That's right, and he's been kind enough to make us that here in St. Louis.
But you sure we're on, though, right?
We are on.
Okay. So what do you want to know? I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Tell us a little bit about what got you into acting.
No, I'm not going to tell you that.
You're not going to tell me that?
Yeah. No, but what got me into acting was I loved Marlon Brando as a boy growing up. I loved Marlon Brando, and I loved James Dean. So they just influenced me in such a fashion, in a personal way, but I wanted to become an actor because of them.
All right. Tell us a little about...
I'm a little bit older than you, Corey, so, but do you think that everybody who's listening will know who Marlon Brando and James Dean is? Because you'd be surprised, some of the, like, some of the 20-year-old actors and actresses that I run into, they don't, you know, it's funny that they don't know the early work of, let's say, Marlon Brando. They, you know, they know from The Godfather, but they don't know, like, from On the Waterfront or something like that.
Right.
Are you well-versed in the movie world?
I am semi-well-versed, I would say.
Okay, well, that's good.
So tell me a little bit about your first acting experiences. Where'd you get your start?
Well, what happened was my family moved out here. It moved out to Los Angeles when I was 15 years old. And I went to Beverly Hills High School in my junior... born in Philadelphia, raised in New Jersey. But then we moved to Beverly Hills when I was 15. So for my junior and senior year, I was at Beverly Hills High School. So I met Richard Dreyfuss, Rob Reiner, and Albert Brooks, who was then known as Albert Einstein. His last name was actually Einstein. So, and he changed it later on. Richard Dreyfuss and I really hit it off. It's like immediately, like in the first week, I gravitated towards the acting, the drama classes, and he was already known as like the best actor at Beverly Hills High School, and he just really liked, he thought I was very talented at 15, but he was already making a living as an actor in like little theater and things like that. So in fact, we did Mad Dog Time together, and I wrote and directed and starred and produced it with his partner Judith James. And we also did a movie called The Big Fix together. And, you know, he's just been a very, very great friend.
All right.
Did that answer your question?
That did answer my question.
Did I over-answer you?
You did not. You cannot over-answer my question. I have a question for you. This is kind of something I've been trying to pull out for the more recent interviews that I've done. Is what is your, since having been in movies and in the entertainment industry, what is your favorite story? What is that thing, like the behind the scenes thing, the thing that maybe, you know, the people just watching the film wouldn't know, or just your
of ones that I've done?
Yeah, just your favorite experience of having worked in film and in the entertainment industry.
I got a zillion of those things.
Share what you like.
I mean, there are some stories I can't tell you.
Why is that? What's going on?
Let's see, my favorite stories. I mean, there's a zillion. Like for when we did Hellride, I became close to David Carradine because we bonded because I was in Kill Bill, and of course he's Bill in Kill Bill. And it was originally written. Quentin wrote it as one movie. You know, he shot it as one movie, but then he divided it into. So there were so many parties, with the rap parties and the premiere parties. It went on for years. You know. And I bonded with David Carradine, so I said, I'm going to do this movie called Hellride, a motorcycle movie. I want you to be a part of it. It's got, I think that if there's four parts and stuff like that that he could do, and he should pick one, you know. So anyway, he picked the one that I could get him out in a day because he was going to get paid the same amount whether he worked for a day or a week or 2 weeks. Right. It was just our budget. It was just the way it was, you know. So I actually kill him in the movie, but it's like a 6-page monologue he has. I interject little things along the way of that monologue, you know, that separates it, but essentially it's a 6-page monologue. So when I go to, I hadn't seen him maybe in a little bit. So I went to his dressing room the day that I knew that he was going to work. And I gave him a big hug and a kiss and said, I can't wait, you know, to do the scene with you. And he looked at me, he said, I'm not memorizing all this dialogue. I'm not memorizing this. This is too much dialogue. This is like, it was 6 pages. He says, this is too much. I said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll put it on cue cards. And I'll have to, but if you watch Hellride, the scene between me and David Carradine, when I'm sitting right across from him, okay? It's a little bit like an interrogation scene, but I have the cue cards between my legs. So not only am I acting and directing and making sure as a writer that he's saying the right words, which he did. He was letter perfect. But I had to flip the cue cards, you know, so that the camera couldn't see. I had to put it in a certain angle, you know. So it was like but I never saw him look at the cue card, so that was the amazing thing. So I didn't know whether he was putting me on or not. I didn't know. You know, I mean, either he's the greatest person, and he really knew how to use cue cards, because I never saw him look down. I swear to God. But I didn't want to not have them there because, I mean, he was really specific. He was like, you know, he said, "I'm not memorizing this thing," but it looked to me like he had it down cold. You know.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. So you've done writing, you've done directing, you've done acting. As far as your personal preferences, what do you like best?
I like all of them because they access different parts of your brain, and it's just a good thing to be able to do all of it. The toughest one is writing, though, I have to say. The toughest one is writing. Acting, for one reason, for a specific reason, that when you're acting and directing, the movie's already going, you know. I mean, if you get hired as an actor, or you know, I mean, and when you start directing them, you're going already, okay? You know, you're in pre-production. But with the writing, it's you with a piece of paper and a pencil, sitting down one night going like, you know, maybe this will work, of course you believe it'll work, but you know how the world is. Maybe it, you know, so yeah, and it, so I mean, and also you have to go in on yourself in a different way than the acting. Acting is going out. You just, the feelings go out. You go very inward. You know, if I'm it's like a little bit of you go into a little bit of, not not clinically, but a little bit like mad. You go like a little mad in your brain when you start to write, because it's, you're so into you. So in other words, you have to come out of your brain sooner or later. And that's the danger, is once you're doing it for, let's say, 3 or 4 months, you really don't want to come out, you know. So, but it's always good to be able to know you're making the movie, you know, so that's good.
Yeah. So, having
that... answering these well for you?
You're doing great. You're doing great. So, having done the...
how big is your audience?
We have, on an average, about 500 people a month come to listen to us and that type of thing, so... We get a couple thousand people a year. It's pretty nice. So when you're out and you're doing acting and all that stuff, and you've done all the projects you have, is there something that you want to do that you haven't done yet? Is there a project or something?
Yeah, it's One Way Ride I want to do.
One Way Ride?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about it.
I can't.
It's
so
profane.
It's so.
Lay it on us.
No, it's.
Have you met Segment Producer Joe? Because Segment Producer Joe is profane, so you're fine.
It's just very, very out there. It's further out there than it, like, makes Last Tango in Paris like the looking like they were just goofing around. You know, so it's a, you know. But I definitely want to do. I could do it inexpensively too. You know. So.
Have you ever thought about maybe doing an Indiegogo or a Kickstarter or something to maybe produce the project?
I mean, it's a bit, since it's started happening, all ideas, I like digesting all ideas, whether I choose to do something like that, I don't know, but in other words, it's interesting.
So, what have you been doing now? What's your current...
I've got 4 projects that I'm moving forward, okay, so, I mean, I'm starring in all of them, I'm directing them, I wrote them all, and I'll be one of the producers of everything. So it's just some are more expensive than the others. The One Way Ride is the least expensive. I'm writing the sequel to The Hell Ride, so it'll be volume 2. That's kind of a low budget. Quentin dictates the budgets on that one. So, but it's a low. It fits with a motorcycle movie. And then I have some gangster movies that are, you know, somewhat more expensive because the look has to be more elegant, you know. So it's just a matter of, it's like a horse race. You one day this one's ahead, then the next day that the other one's ahead. So.
Okay, so where can people find out more about you and your projects and that kind of thing? Do you have
Corey,
like a...
Talk to Corey. Corey is the best person to find out everything about me. I have no idea. I'm not on any...
Nothing.
I'm just, nothing. No, I have people who are fake me's. People
really?
That... Yeah, no, I have fake people on, like, Facebook and stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah,
how do you feel about that when you learned about it?
Well, when people call me, I said... So they said there are people who are fake yous. I said, but are they nice fake me's? Are they saying nice things about the people who ask them questions? Because you know, in other words, I don't know. It's so crazy, the whole thing. You know, so.
Well, I'd like to thank you for taking some time out of your day to speak with us.
My
I really
pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Anytime you want to do it. Yeah. Next first time when I come back to St. Louis again, you, Corey.
Thank you.
Another one.
Thank you very much.
Okay, great.
And that was my interview with Mr. Larry Bishop.
Fascinating.
Yep, he was... Dan, you're awesome.
I'm an awesome wingman.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'd do without you.
Oh, I do.
That was rhetorical. But anyway...
What?
He had also worked with the... on, I guess, several occasions with the lady that was sitting to his right.
Mm-hmm.
And she was lovely enough to have me sit with her and talk with her. She's been in a number of films, including one of his. I think she was in Hellride. And she was also in Django Unchained. She played mm-hmm. Leonardo DiCaprio's mm-hmm. sister. And her name is Laura Cayuette. And she was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Again, someone whose work I was kind of
familiar with,
but I was not, you know... Somebody was like, you know, if you mentioned her name to me, I'd be like, hold on. And then, you know, you have to figure
mm-hmm,
it out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, instantly someone that I knew once, you know, names had been brought up. And she had some of the greatest behind-the-scenes stories Because that was one of the things I was kind of going for. Yeah, something just a little different.
Your thing this year was behind-the-scenes stories.
And I think that, you know, it's something that is actually kind of... I might probably just stick with when I go to do these, because I think that they are a lot of fun, and it makes it more interesting than somebody just kind of regurgitating their career, which is something I think they have to do more often than not. But when they get a chance to share something with you from, you know, that we don't see on screen or... whatever, that's a lot of fun, and she had several. So here it is, my interview with Miss Laura Caillouette.
Hello, everybody. This is Corey, and I'm with Laura Caillouette. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How'd you get your start in theater acting?
Oh wow, it was a long time ago. I did start in theater, though. I started in New York, and I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts and did a whole bunch of theater off, way the heck off Broadway, and. And then I moved to LA and studied some more and did some more theater. And then I did the sequel to Terms of Endearment. And that was my first movie, surrounded by Academy Award winners. Yeah.
Can't have a better way to start than that.
No, it seems to be a theme for me. So.
Tell us a little bit about working on Django Unchained.
Oh, wow. It was probably the most grueling shoot of my entire career, but also the most rewarding. It was an amazing experience.
What is it like? How'd you meet Quentin Tarantino and all that?
Well, we met a long time ago at a party that a friend of mine was having. And we ended up getting in this very long conversation. And... I mean, hours conversation. And at some point, they were clearing the house out. And anybody who was really, truly a friend of the owner of the home was sent upstairs. And anybody who was just there for a party was asked to leave. And there were these two giant bouncers at the bottom of the stairs. And so, you know, as Quentin and I were still talking. And so we're walking toward the door. They're pushing everybody toward the door. And I... automatically go toward the staircase and start to go up the stairs, and the bouncers nod their heads at me, and then they stop Quentin, and I said, oh no, he's with me. And he had never asked who I was or what I did or whatever, but I think at that moment he was like, wait a minute, this girl has more juice than I do. You know, like, what just happened here? So we continued talking and talked and talked, so we talked.
He is a talker, and that's one of the signatures of all of his scripts and everything, is the dialogue.
Yeah.
Did you find that the dialogue was something of a challenge in the script, or would you...
You know, it's funny. Laura Lee is written very open. If you were to read... If you've seen the comic books, which are out now, and my part's starting to be introduced in the last one, when you read the comic books, I think it's easy to see that the dialogue's actually very open. It's things like, y'all are not from around here. You know, it's not things that are inherently... characterizing, but he knew that I'd know what to do with it.
All right, so I've been wanting to do this with like a lot of conventions that we go to and interviews that we do with different celebrities and stuff, and I wanted to ask somebody, we all see you guys on screen, and we all know there's another life beyond the screen, and you have a backstage or behind the scenes story. What is your favorite one of those, like something that the public doesn't see on screen, or but like your favorite behind the scene moment or whatever?
You know what, it happens a lot. The thing about doing this for a living is that you get to see things that, as you said, nobody else gets to see. Like, I remember when I was starting out, I did this episode of Friends, and they needed to shoot the promo, the opening. You know how Friends used to open with like a cold open, like 2-3 minute thing? And next door to our stage was this movie called Father's Day that starred Billy Crystal and Robin Williams. And so they were right next door, so they planned on using them somehow, but they couldn't really. They're making a movie next door. So they called in Robbie Benson, who was going to be directing the next episode, and they had Robin and Billy Crystal come in during their lunch break, and they just shot the open with no studio audience. And we, who were, you know, we the actors, got to be the studio audience. So we stood really close around so that the mics would hear us. And so I'm literally 15 feet away from the scene watching a half hour of straight improv between two of the greatest improv artists alive or dead. And we're the only ones that saw it. Now, y'all get to see the 2 minutes that they put in the show, but we saw half an hour of that, and we were hurting. We were, you know, holding our sides, laughing so hard. And so things like that, which on Django, my moment like that on Django, that I was like, wow, I can't believe I'm the only one that gets to see this. We were out at the plantation getting ready to die, as it turns out. Spoiler alert. So we're all out in our funeral garb, and Sam Jackson is wearing, you know, a velvet-trimmed vest, and he's looking a little gothic, and he's got that gray hair and stuff, and his cane. And we're walking back from the plantation, which had already been blown up, so it... You know, in the film, it looks like we're walking to it, but in real life, we're just walking to the shell of it, all blown up, still smoking from 2 days ago. And so they were resetting the cameras, and we used to play music in between. Quentin likes to have music playing in between setups. So we're out in the middle of these cane fields in Louisiana, and Thriller comes on. And Sam Jackson starts to do beat for beat, move for move, the entire Thriller dance in that outfit in a cane field with a burned out plantation in the background. I mean, it was the most amazing thing. I was like, I can't believe that only, like, you know, less than 100 people are watching this. And most of them were working. So, yeah. So you have those on everything where... when we were doing Mad Dog Time, I got to see... I was videotaping everybody doing impersonations, and I got lots and lots of impersonations. But at some point, I got Gabriel Byrne impersonating Jeff Goldblum while Jeff Goldblum impersonated Gabriel Byrne to each other. So, yeah.
That's amazing. So tell us, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
I just did a little part in American Heist, which is Hayden Christensen's next movie. And then I have a movie coming out called The Loft, which is it's a remake of a Belgian movie that's a suspense movie. I think it's going to be pretty good. And then I have Treme final season. I have a little moment in that where I come back as David Morse's wife, ex-wife. And I'm doing True Detective. I did an episode of True Detective with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Right now in the theaters, I have Now You See Me with Woody Harrelson. I did a scene. I'm forgetting things. There's more, but that's a summation.
That's a lot of...
Student Bodies. I haven't shot that yet, though, so you shouldn't probably talk about it because it's not in the can yet.
Okay. Well, where can people find you online? Where can they learn more about you?
Well, you can follow me at nosmallparts.com, spelled K-N-O-W, nosmallparts.com. At nosmallparts. You can also find nosmallparts.com if you're interested in my book. But you can find me at lauracayouette.com. And I also write a blog called L.A. to NOLA. I lived in L.A. for 18 years, and now I live in New Orleans. And I've been writing basically a four-year love letter to the city of New Orleans. And... if you're traveling there, it's got a page of favorite things. So, but yeah, I'm online. You can find me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day. I really appreciate you talking to us.
Oh, thank you so much.
And that is my interview with Miss Laura Caillouette.
Fascinating.
Yes, it was amazing. And I love talking to her. I could have sat and talked with her all day. She was great. So, and she had a book out there too called No Small Roles.
Okay.
And it was K-N-O-W, which means to basically...
Oh, no small roles.
Yes, right. Which, like, they're, it's to, like, figure out how to make the most of any part and to kind of, you know... Because you can... She's kind of made her career, you know, by really just delving into small roles and, like... These directors and producers and everybody love her for it.
Yep.
So, you know, it's actually a book that I'm probably, you know, because Nicholas is, my son is into acting, and it might be something I want to introduce him to. And
you're going to read a book?
You know, it's crazy. You know, I'm a little old-fashioned sometimes with the kids and the books and whatnot. We sit down with a book and a Jell-O pudding pop, and it is amazing. But yeah, I'm going to have to find out if the book would be appropriate to share with my son, who is only 11. But yeah, you know, because he really wants to be in acting and, you know, stage and whatnot. So that would be something I think would be interesting for him. You know, and I try and share the stories that I, when I talk to these people, you know, their stories with him to so that he can kind of get a little understanding about the world that they're, that, you know, he wants to go into. So, beyond that, and Contamination 2013, segment producer and there we go, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was good.
Segment producer Joe and I went out this week, and we went and watched Riff Tracks Live. And Riff Tracks Live was doing a cut-up of Starship Troopers. The Paul Verhoeven...
masterpiece.
Yes, masterpiece. Which disappointed all the Starship Trooper fans out there because it did not have powered armor in it.
Yeah, that was a little disappointing.
See, now there was a point where I differed. A, the movie and the book, nothing alike anyway.
Yeah, and we can have that discussion again. Although I will have you ever seen the cartoon? They came out with a series of cartoons. Yeah,
the computer animated one.
That was actually pretty decent. I'm not gonna say they're awesome. They were pretty cool.
I never watched those.
I watched them. I haven't watched them all. I watched, I think, the first series. They made like three or four like six episode mini series things. They're not too bad.
Yeah,
and they have power armor.
There you go. See, and I read the book on the recommendation of several people who basically said it was an inspiration for the film Aliens. Yeah. It was an inspiration for a lot of different things, and that, you know, this power armored stuff was amazing and all that. And I got into the book, and the book is much more government, military theory and almost doctrine. And there's not a lot about the Bug War, and there's almost nothing about these power suits. But it is obviously enough of an idea that it has sparked. Just the idea of these power suits has sparked things. I was reading about the Japanese anime Mobile Suit Gundam.
Yeah.
And the creators of that show and series and everything else had basically said, he said that reading Starship Troopers and hearing about the powered armor fueled his imagination, and he tried to imagine what that would be like, and it kind of turned into the suits that you see in Mobile Suit Gundam, which are much, much bigger than what I guess they would use in Starship Troopers.
Yeah, the mobile suit, like the Gundams, are more like mechs. You're actually you're riding them. You're not like a power armor where they are surrounding you and augmenting your natural abilities.
But beyond the intricacies of the book and the film and all of its peripherals, Riff Tracks Live really made that movie great on a whole nother level. And they are doing, I guess, an encore presentation in September as well. And I highly recommend, if you're a fan of, like, Mystery Science Theater 3000, and if you liked Starship Troopers on any level, go and watch the film. They do a great job of just, you know, just pointing out stuff, making you laugh, making their own jokes in there about a bunch of different things. And you get to enjoy the wonder and amazement that is a Gorillagram. So I won't spoil what that is for you, but if you go see Starship Troopers Riff Tracks Live, you'll get to enjoy the Gorillagram. So,
well, I was gonna say, I'm gonna throw one more thing in here. I think this is the first podcast we've done since the new Doctor has been announced.
Yep.
And have you seen all the Peter Capparelli? Yeah, Capaldi. Yeah. Have you seen anything about him?
I've seen his face.
You saw the picture, that was it.
Yeah.
So, Tina and I, Tina Sabi, I bought, because I couldn't
Intern
rent it.
Intern Tina.
We can't call her that anymore. It's Tina Sabi. Peter Capaldi was in a British TV show in the thick of it. The Thick of It. And apparently he's very, very famous for the show, and that is his... He is like, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of actors don't like to become typecast. Well, he has become typecast as like his character from that show, and he is a foul-mouthed political backroom dealer.
Uh-huh.
He's kind of like the political fixer.
Right.
And I will say, as an American, it can be a little difficult to watch because you're dealing with the intricacies of the British parliamentary system.
Right.
Which, as I know nothing about. So it's like, it takes a little while for you to kind of get going, but it's actually a really good show. It's definitely a drama. Like, maybe, you know, bordering just a little bit on comedy from, like, just the harshness of, like, some of the drama.
Right.
But Peter Capaldi is, like, a really good actor. And if you start looking through his IMDb database, he was in World War Z. He was one of the doctors, the WHO doctors, the World Health Organization doctors. Apparently, he was one of the many doctors you see.
Okay.
And then he's played lesser roles in a number of American movies and played bigger roles in British movies, British TV. He was, like, as going through it, it was like, you know, Tina Sabe and I have been watching, like, a fair amount of British TV, and we were surprised by going, oh, he was in, like, the Vassar of Dibby, or and it's like all these kind of well-known British TV shows, he had prominent starring characters in there. And he's a little bit older. He's, like, he's 50, which, ironically, is the same age that Hartnell was when he started the first Doctor. He was 50, even though he was 50 going on, like, 70. That guy looked old.
William Hartnell was only 50 when he played the Doctor?
Yeah.
Holy crud.
Yeah.
That guy looked like...
Uh-huh. Oof. Uh-huh. So, Peter Capaldi is, like, you know, 50 going on 40. You know, so there's been a little bit of outcry about from
Are you
some...
sure he was only 50?
Wikipedia has never lied to me before, all right? But that has been quoted a number of times across different Doctor Who pages that he's the same age as.
Okay.
So hey, take that for what you will.
You know, I have to admit that I was happy to see them go older.
Older, I was too, very much so.
We were talking about that and debating it a bit about whether they, you know, because there's been a lot of talk about should they do a woman doctor or should they do another ethnicity or should they do, you know, older. So. I'm kind of glad that they steered away from the young guys.
Yeah.
I've recently started going back through and watching because I've seen a great number of the episodes from every one of the new Doctors type seasons and everything, but I have not seen, I don't think, any of the seasons completely through. The one that I'd seen the most of his season was Christopher Eccleston. Mm-hmm. I saw most of his, but I hadn't seen all of it.
Yeah.
You
kind of missed the whole Bad Wolf thing and all
that. Well, I
was
trying to figure out, it was like, I knew that there was something with, I knew Bad Wolf, but I was trying to figure out what it was, and then it's like, Rose is like, oh, I sent a message to myself through time, and it was like, oh, okay, sure. Mm. You know, I don't know how you pulled that off. I guess it was when you were merged with the TARDIS, then it retroacted back to whatever. Sure.
Don't break down the plots too much. It'll start hurting a little bit.
Yeah. Christopher Eccleston was, from the different Doctors that I've seen, he was my favorite because he had a little bit of an edge.
He was.
And I liked that. I liked that he had that. And David Tennant, which I just started watching, he's kind of got it in this first Christmas episode, a little bit of an edge to him. But I know from watching him later
he
on,
really
as time
loses
goes through,
that edge.
He loses it and he becomes kind of this soft, I don't want to say crybaby doctor, but
I get really tired of the and this is you and I have talked about this on the show before too. I get really tired of the I bring horrible things, I kill worlds, you know, I'm good, I'm bad. I get a little tired of that after a while.
Yeah, and I get tired of it's like the doctor can kill somebody one second, but cannot justify anybody else doing it.
Yeah.
It's like he is the only moral barometer that swings true is his own. And I'm like, eh, okay, whatever. But there's like the end of the Christmas special that I just literally, before you got here, just got done watching. He kills the leader of this alien race who kind of doesn't keep true to his word.
Yeah.
And then tells the alien race to bug off and tell everybody to, you know,
the doctor's here.
Yeah, and stay away from Earth. And then the Prime Minister lady back on Earth, she's in contact with Torchwood and tells them to fire the Death Star ray.
Yeah.
and blow up the ship. And they do it. And the doctor says, what are you doing? You just murdered all those people. And she goes, you told me that they were going to be, you know, going out there and talking about us, and I have to protect ourselves, and you're not always here. And it's like, there's part of me watching this where I'm like, you know, she's got a point. Mm-hmm. You aren't always there to save the day. You know, shit happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a pretty powerful message from the human race. I don't know why they don't use that Death Star railer more often.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, something's coming. Torchwood, Death Star Ray, please. You know, but I'm sorry. That was a direct ripoff of Star Wars. 5 points of light come up from
fire the ion cannon.
Yeah, fire come up, make a pyramid in London, and a beam shoots out and blows up this thing in space. I was like, George Lucas is going to be suing somebody.
That's right.
He sees that. You better hope, you know.
You know, I will say, you know, I think you're going to kind of find as you go through the different series, you know, apparently there was a change in writers. Like Russell T. Davies did a lot of, right, and then Peter Moffat has done like all the later ones. And I've noticed that the Doctor Who episodes get really big, like where they're moving the Earth and the aliens are coming, and like it's all about the world. And then I've noticed, like, for this last Doctor, the stories are getting smaller. Like they're more interpersonal, on a less, like, more either dealing with the Doctor himself or smaller consequent. You know, it's like they're less about the whole world,
the
or moving the world, or the universe is coming down.
Well,
and I kind of like that.
Yeah, and the thing is, it needs to step away from that,
mm-hmm,
for a while. Because while everybody loves a great, big, epic,
mm-hmm,
crazy adventure, you can't do it every week. And you can't do it every week, every season.
And I will say that the shows are limited. And this is a complaint I've heard, you know, a number of places is, you know, each season's 8 episodes? 10?
13.
13?
12,
okay, 13. Thank you. You know, that's, you know, you have 12 hours to kind of, like, lay out, and Doctor Who episodes can be very complex. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on there. You know, you got, like, time travel, and then, oh, did you tell yourself in the past to do this thing, and blah, blah,
right,
blah, Bad Wolf, I sent myself a message, blah, blah. So, you know, it's like that's not a lot of time to lay out a very complex story that's supposed to be dribbled out to you in little bits that you're supposed to put together. So it's like, if you're trying to do a big epic scale event every season, that can get a little tiresome.
Yeah. So it's nice to, when they step away from it. I tell you where I've noticed that epic thing in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
We were role playing,
mm-hmm,
with one of our friends from Game Night, Shannon.
Oh.
And Shannon, it was right when Shannon started learning to GM.
Oh, okay.
And Shannon started off these games, these D&D campaigns,
mm-hmm,
and there was a big epic orc battle,
mm-hmm,
that kind of kicked off the adventure and did all this stuff, and we were forced to kind of flee, which was kind of fun and epic, and we got to this next place, and the orc army came, and we were trying to fortify it, but they somehow had greater numbers, and they swarmed that place, and we had to run from that place. And this became the steadily growing progression of this game, where it was run to new noble city, tell them to put up their defenses. They're like, there can't be that many orcs. Orcs out the wazoo. They're coming in waves over the wall, everything. There's orcs everywhere. Try and kill them. Try and defend the city. City falls. Run to next city. And
wash, rinse, repeat.
Yes. And you can't continue. It's something that I think all good shows need to do, is they need to step away and either make the story smaller, answer some questions,
mm-hmm,
do it, you know. You can't constantly twist the plot and make it epic and do all these things and not ever unwind it all.
Yeah.
You have to bring it all back down to a focus. You have to let your character settle.
And this is what I'm hoping
and
about,
then build it all up
bring
again.
It back to Peter Capaldi. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing his name. I'm horrible with names.
They're screaming at you right now.
Yeah, they are. At their car stereos as they drive to work in the morning. You know, being that he's a little older, that maybe you won't have so much of the David Tennant, you know, running. We run everywhere. Run. You know, maybe he'll be a little like, okay, we're going to solve this here. We're not going to run across the ship and then run all the way back. You know, it'll be a little, like, a more of a Tom Baker, you know, like, oh, you know, not quite as frantic, or maybe frantic in different ways, not just, like, physically, like, oh, run it. You know, and one of the other things that I've read about, you know, that could be good about this new Doctor is that because the actor is an established actor and is arguably either at the height or coming down on the backside of his career,
mm-hmm.
that this could be a really good role for him to, like, settle into for a while. Like, right. like you could have an epic length, because part of the reason that, you know, Eccleston and Tennant and all these guys, like, only do, like, well, in Eccleston's case, he only did one season, which I always thought was weird.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, you do a couple, two or three or four, is that you don't want to get locked in. You know, you do Doctor Who and get kind of popular, like, well, there's other things you can do. You do movies, you can, you know, there is, like, a world of acting awesomeness for you to go to, where Peter might be like, well, you know, I've done all that. And he is a lifelong fan of Doctor Who. The BBC dug up a letter from their archives that he wrote when he was 12 and mailed to them asking for more episodes.
Huh.
So he is like a bona fide lifelong Doctor Who fan. And so, you know, they're thinking that this may be a role that he just may settle into for, like, you know, a decade was one place I read said he could do this thing for like 10 years and become the next, like, you know,
Tom Baker.
And he may not care. Like, you know, because when you do that, you're going to be known as the Doctor. Oh, that's the guy that played the Doctor. He may be like, I'm cool with that.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm very excited. Like I said, it's like I've watched some shows with him in it. He is a very good actor. I think he definitely has the ability to have the presence. I know you're not going to get the Malcolm Tucker from the thick of it, the foul mouth.
Here's what I was wanting to ask you. Since he's been typecast as these particular types of, you know, tough guy, foul role, do you think that they might translate that over just to flip the coin on the Doctor for a little bit?
I think what you may have, and this is my own, like, complete personal, you know, theory, is that what you may have is, you know, you're going to deal with the John Hurt Doctor now.
Right.
Who is, I am just going to throw it out there, is, like, could be the bad guy Doctor, or have some conflicted things going on that you're going to deal with him, and you're still going to have the current Doctor, and then you're going to transform into Peter Capaldi, that maybe you keep some of that gruffness, you know, that while he may not be foul mouthed, quote unquote,
right,
but maybe it would be a little bit, he go back to being a little more abrupt, a little bit more Gandalf, I guess, in a way, where it's like, you know, I'm not early, I'm not, you know, I'm exactly where I need to be, you know, instead of where you get kind of the theory now, they're all kind of running around and all like, oh, you know, where he may be like, hey, the Doctor is here.
Right.
Which I think would be a cool change of pace. I think it'd be a good offset for Clara as a companion. Because Clara as a companion so far, you want to talk about a compressed story kind of shoved in there. the last half season, like after the Pons left, you know, their story arc ended, they just shoved the Clara story arc, I mean, like a ramrod through.
Huh.
To the point where basically at the final episode of the season, they had to just explain it. Like usually Doctor Who seems to do a pretty good job of, like, dribbing out the storyline where you kind of start putting things together. Nobody knew what the hell was going on with Clara. It was like they did not do a very good job of giving you clues. It's like you're just like, this girl is weird and she's, like, showing up in the Doctor's past and she has all these abilities and has no idea why she has abilities. And then suddenly the last episode, they just had to explain it.
Hmm.
She went into the Doctor's time hole.
That's right. I forgot all about that.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that now, and they've even said that you are going to see Clara's humanity. So maybe she will, you know, like her character will become a character. Cause right now it hasn't really been a character. She's been like this weird thing. and then you're going to have Peter Capaldi, and then, you know, I am very excited because apparently the 50th anniversary is going to be really, really epic. Like they're talking about this thing's going to be awesome. They're going to get a lot. They're either going to get actors to play the old doctors or get the old doctors to come back. Apparently, they've got the rumor mill is they have the guy that played the 8th Doctor that did the American TV miniseries.
Yeah, I don't know.
McGain. He apparently filmed something already, and so the rumor is that maybe he. You're going to get to see, it may either be like a web only thing, or maybe it'll be part of like a trailer or the very beginning of the show. Is there, what they're thinking is you will see him regenerate into John Hurt. Like you'll see that, you know.
That'd be neat. And then, you got to see the Seventh Doctor regenerated into him.
Yeah, they brought back Sylvester McCoy to do, yeah. And then, so yeah, so what they're talking about is like, because you never got to see what happened with Eccleston. He was just there. So you may get to see some of that intermediate, you know, because they've already said that John Hurt's going to fit in between Eccleston and McGain. Like, or, yeah. Sorry, I'm mispronouncing his name. You can yell at the radio. But yeah, so they've already said that he's going to fit in there. So technically, all the doctors are going to get bumped up a number, you know, because he's going to be this phantom doctor wedged in the middle there. So yeah, it's like I'm very excited. I'm very excited for the 50th anniversary. I'm very excited for the Christmas special.
Have you heard Eccleston's going to be in
the? Supposedly, yeah, they're going to have Eccleston, Tennant, like everyone's going to be in this 50th anniversary. They are the BBC is really, you know, on like a business note. They are just cashing. I mean, like, cha-ching. It's like you know, they are putting out, like, they're getting special coins minted. It's like the New Zealand Mint is putting out a, like, an official coin, like, collector coin. They are just, oh my god, they are just milking this thing like crazy. And it's awesome because you can go to the store now and buy all sorts of crazy Doctor Who stuff now. Doctor Who ice cube trays, by the way.
Yay.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah.
One last question about the new Doctor, yeah. And then we'll start wrapping this thing up. Do you think his sonic screwdriver will go old school with like the little radar dish type thing at the top? Or do you think they'll embrace his kind of negative, stereotyped casting and make it look like a 45?
Like a 45, yeah. No, I think they're going to go old school, and it's going to be something that's easily replicated into a prop that they can sell at Borders. that is what I believe.
It's going to be a tire gauge.
That's right. Oh, well, now it seems your TARDIS is a few pounds low on time pressure.
All right. We have one last thing for you that we've already recorded.
Yep.
And we're going to throw that on the end of here. We were talking about the Kickstarter for the board game Shuriken. And the gentleman that was the creator of that game was kind enough to...
Yep, Brian Wood.
Brian Wood was kind enough to Skype with me and talk to me about that stuff. And unfortunately, Skype was being
dumb. We had a
computer
malfunction.
And it didn't record, but Dan and I sat down and talked about it, and I conveyed all the things that he had said, and we talked about all the things that went into making this game. And unfortunately, they've already pulled the funding for this Kickstarter, but it was an interesting conversation enough in itself about board games on Kickstarter and what it takes to get them going and the prices and just to be aware of some stuff. So I think we're just going to close it out and say, here's that interview and us talking about Brian Wood, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
All right. Have a week.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Nerdy Times. With me always is Dan.
Hello.
Segment producer Joe is here.
Hey, they finally let me out of the box again.
Yep.
Again.
We might just have to let you sit on the box from now on.
Oh, that's what she said.
Yep.
See, now I have to edit.
Oh, that wasn't dirty.
Nothing dirty about that.
Yeah.
Wholesome boxing.
Anyway, we had a guy that was... We spotlighted his Kickstarter, and he was doing a board game, a big board game called Shuriken. It's about ninja battles. And he contacted us and said thanks for... spotlighting us on the show, and then he sent another email press release out saying that they were going to make his Kickstarter a Kickstarter exclusive, which means if you wanted the board game or any of the perks or exclusives or anything, it was only going to be for Kickstarter people, so if you had to fund it then. Otherwise, there was nothing. Mm-hmm. And there were some blowback we got from some of the people that listened to the show that said that, you know, he only did that in order to boost his donations. And he doesn't shy away from that completely, because basically said that doing this board game would run about $90,000 and they weren't going to reach their goal. Or at least he didn't think they were.
He didn't have it pre-funded
or anything. This was something that had to be funded up to the $95,000 range in order to get printed. So he said that this was basically what he called the nuclear option, which was like, we're not going to make it, so screw it. It's going to only be Kickstarter exclusive, so if you want it, this is the way it's going to go down. So
if you don't do it, it doesn't get released.
Yep. And we had a long talk about Kickstarter. We talked about board games. The guy used to work for Fantasy Flight Games.
And I guess we should say, I don't think we said at the beginning, that we tried to record the interview and we had computer issues.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't get the actual interview. So what you have is Corey and I talking about the interview that we did with Brian Wood.
So, yeah, his name is Brian Wood. He used to work for Fantasy Flight Games in the sales. He said he's done a lot of playtesting for Fantasy Flight while he was there. He's worked for other game companies doing different jobs and playtesting and creating games. So he knows quite a bit about the company and everything. And one of the things he was saying about Kickstarter is, he said, if you see a game on Kickstarter, a big box game, and he says, and they're asking for $20,000 or $30,000, he says, those people have the money already to print the game.
Yeah.
He says that it...
if they don't already have it done.
Yeah.
Right?
He says, you cannot get a game printed for less than $90,000 to $100,000. He goes, so if somebody's out there asking for $20,000 or $30,000 to print a big box game style game, he says they have the money, and what they're doing is they're trying to raise extra capital in order to basically get a higher print run.
Yeah.
But what they do is they strip down the game that they're going to release anyway in its entirety, and they strip it down to its most basic, simple playing elements, and they say that's the game. And that's, you know, what they will release if they get $20,000. However, if they reach stretch goals, quote unquote, then they'll basically, what he says, what they'll do is they'll basically say, well, if we reach $30,000, we'll be able to add this figure in, and that will add another game mechanic. And then if you reach this stretch goal, we'll add this, you know, this thing back in. And he says, so basically, they just start basically putting the game back together the more and more stretch goals that they reach. So he said, and I asked him, does anybody ever just use this just to recoup the cost? So it's like, oh, we got $95,000 we're going to spend. Let's see what we can get from Kickstarter to cut our losses, and, you know, maybe we'll only have to wind up spending $30,000. And he's like, yeah, he wouldn't be surprised if some people did that too. So, but he told us about the Shuriken game, and he said it's a cross between a Euro game and an Ameritrash game. And he said Ameritrash games tend to be much more fast-paced, action-oriented games, and he said a Euro Trash game is much more resource management. And he says, and this game, he said, he feels is kind of a nice blend of both.
Yeah.
He says you got a little bit of resource management, you got a little bit of action, and he says the game takes place on this board that's all kind of destructible, and it sounds really, really interesting and fun. And they're what, like 40? You said they were at $40,000.
Well, I was looking, and I thought they were at 40, but I think they're only to 30. Maybe they were at 23 when we talked about them like two weeks ago.
How much time is left for these guys?
They got almost 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So, yeah. Well, so what he says is it's not impossible for him to reach his goal. I think they're...
So by the time you hear this, they'll be on the end of their two weeks probably.
So, you know, it's like, while I understand why they're probably, maybe not but they're...
cynical.
They're cynical, thank you, about getting it. It's like, I think, you know, Kickstarters tend to be a lot like eBay auctions. You get a lot of action at the beginning and at the end.
Yep.
So I wouldn't surprise me to see over the next 2 weeks or maybe the last few days they get a huge, like a bump.
Definitely. From what he described of the game and everything, it did sound like it was going to be a lot of fun, especially if you're in ninjas
The Kickstarter, you know, for a $75 pledge, you get the game.
Yeah, you get the whole game,
and that's comparable, if not a little less than what you would pay at, like, you know,
at
the Game Shop for a similar style game,
a Fantasy Flight game,
$100 now. And
some of them are anywhere from $80 to $100. So $75 is well reasonable. It's not outside the you know, the realm of possibility.
And he had something interesting to say about one of your, one of the games you had interesting time with Android.
Yeah, Fantasy Flight put out a game called Android, and the guy that runs our board game nights was giddy about this game coming out. He could not wait, and he finally got it. He dropped the $80 for it, and I was telling him about it, and I was kind of wanting to know if he had heard about it. And he's like, "Yeah, I know the guy that designed it," and he said, "You know, the guy, there was kind of a gleam in his eye for a long time to want to make this game." And he said it was a very, very niche game in his inception of it, for a very, very specific type of player. And he said those players will love this game. Everybody else, you know, I don't know if it'll be their game, but you know, these certain players will love this game. And he says, and those people do love that game. And he goes, everybody else's reaction. And I said, well, I can tell you our reaction. And I told him, you know, we sat around playing this game, or learning the rules for about 2 hours. When I started at 6, it was almost 9 o'clock before we started playing the game. And the
only reason we started was because we're all like, I know there's still more rules to learn. That's how big this game is on rules.
Yeah.
We're like, I know there's still more rules. Let's just start and play and learn as we're playing.
Yeah, because this is too much. And he starts laughing. I'm telling him this, and he's laughing and laughing. He goes, he's like, go on. So I said, we played the game for probably 4 or 5 hours. It was 1:30, almost 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't even know if that we were halfway through the game, but we could kind of see where it was going, and we were just like, screw it. This game sucks.
It's kinda,
we don't want to play it anymore.
I would say, you know, if you ever never played it or just interested in getting it, it's, in my opinion, it was kind of like a whodunit Clue kind of game.
It was like the most overblown, complicated game of Clue you would ever want to play. And the more and more I couldn't tell you everything about it now, but the more and more you played it, the more and more I thought, you know, once we get to the end of this, that's pretty much the ending that's going to happen every time.
Mm-hmm.
There are very, very few things
that would change that when you replay it again.
That would change when you replayed it. So the game had kind of a limited outcome, too, which really kind of made it like, okay, you paid $80 or $85 for this game, so it's not...
You want a lot of replay value.
Right. On that kind of money. Yeah.
Yep.
Even Clue has more replay value.
Yeah.
To a $20 game.
Yeah. So... There is just a number of things that didn't make that game great, and he said that they were.
I mean, if you are someone, it's not to interrupt you. If you're somebody that's played it before, you're more welcome to email in and, you know, maybe explain to us, you know, what made it so much
better.
Tell
us why we are wrong.
Yeah,
info at nerdytimes.com.
What are you doing?
I'm putting the in front of the Nerdy Times now.
Because it's the Nerdy.
It's
Times.
Not. It's Nerdy
you
Times.
See, you chopped off the.
Yes, the is extraneous.
Yeah, it's awesome. Anyway,
but yeah, please email us.
Yeah, if you've tell had a better experience about it. Tell us about it. We'd love.
Or if you learn a better way of playing it than what we did, who knows? You know, maybe they revised the rules. I can't say.
But this guy, he said that he had almost verbatim the exact same experience we had playing it. They had a guy, and he spent 2.5 hours reading the rules. They said, "Let's just play the game." They played about 4 hours, and they're like, "We're done," and never finished it. And you know, we talked about games that had. What seemed to be a limited amount of playtesting done with them, and he said that that's kind of a tough thing in the board gaming companies. He said if you're a mid-range to large-scale board gaming company, he says you have to produce at least 5 to 7 board game titles a year in order to pay salaries. He says and that's at least that many. And he says, so sometimes the boss just comes down and says, all right, you're done testing this game. Let's box it up,
ship.
Put it out. Yep.
Ship or die.
And he says, and those guys will maybe rush out that weekend to their local hobby store and run game tests just to try and fine-tune everything that they
can.
Yeah. Whatever they can before it has to go out into the printers and everything. So it's not somebody just saying, I need to make money. It's somebody that's like, I have to pay salaries. If we don't get another game out, we aren't going to have the money.
Mm-hmm.
So... maybe that's why some of these games that come out, they have some exploitable game mechanics or whatever. It's because
the Corey rule.
Yeah, it's happened. I've played some games with Joe and, you know, some of our other friends where it's just like, it seems like they have the scenario set up just to go one way. You know, it's
or like a lot of times me and Corey are playing with everybody else, and then I'll either see something that like, this is the only thing I see that's possible, or yeah. Corey will see it, and I'm like, oh, you fucker, you see it before me.
Yeah.
And it'd be me and Corey racing to exploit this game as fast as we can, and it's usually me and him beating the shit out of each other, and everybody else is like, fuck you guys, I'm not playing this game again.
We're not playing with Corey anymore.
Or we all pummel the hell out of Corey.
I get that a lot. Munchkin, I am the bitch at Munchkin, because it's like the minute that they can cornhole the crap out of me, it's on.
That's right.
There's a lot of stuff that goes on at Munchkin that is not pretty.
It's all pretty.
Yeah.
This is not for you.
Yeah. If there's a game or Red Dragon Inn, that's another one where I get bitch slapped. I don't know that I've won a game of that in a long time. Because if there is a point where everybody can gang up on one person and just beat the snot of them, that is the game where I get my comeuppance. So, other than that, we talked about just some of the games that we liked and disliked and that kind of thing. We kind of talked about zombies a little bit, and it's like I kind of liked zombies a lot the first time I played it, but it kind of just seemed to be like a one-note joke of a game.
Didn't you buy that game?
I did buy it. Oh, I wound up selling it. And it's because it's like I just got to the point where it's like I don't want to play it because I know it's just going to wind up being a conga line down to the helicopter at the end, and it was just kind of like eh. And that's how it always seemed to kind of go. And there's a lot of games that I've noticed that kind of do that. And we were talking about that there's, you know, it's nice to have a game with a lot of different replay value. I think one of the things he was talking about with Shuriken is that
it's never the same game twice.
Well, he says it's because you can play clan against clan against clan. Oh, okay. You can play like a three-player game. Me, you, and Dan could all sit down and play.
Well, maybe explain a little to the game. It's got clans, so
each of you play a ninja clan, and I guess you start with so many ninjas on the board, and you're basically trying to take out and kill as many of
the you want to become the head ninja house is what it is. Oh, okay.
So you're fighting in this, you set up the board, and there's different ways to set up the board. And as the board becomes damaged, you flip tiles over and they become, like, destroyed or, you know, so there's a different setting to fight in. And he says, you have three different types of ninjas. You have a ninja that has shuriken, which they will act first. You have a ninja that has a weapon, like a sword, and they will go second. And then you have your hand-to-hand ninjas, which act third. He says, and you get so many action points a turn. So he goes, on your turn, you can pull more ninjas in. You can call more ninjas to the battlefield. He says you can upgrade your ninjas and give them better martial arts or magical powers or whatever, ninja powers. And he says you can move your ninja or you can attack another clan. So those are the four things you can do. And I don't know what kind of resource management there is, but I guess there's things you can do to earn points that allow you to upgrade.
Certain table, maybe parts of the board you control gives you more.
Like I said, I'm completely speculating at this point, but I can only imagine that maybe you hit, like a lot of these games, they have a little, like almost like a placemat that sits in front of you where you have little
things. And it shows you what, if you have this area, you get this much.
Yeah. If you go to the Kickstarter page, you can watch a video. It's got a game.
What is that?
Yeah.
Kickstarter.com, I think it's / Shuriken game. I'll link it in the show notes.
But it would be a nice game to see if it could get funded all the way through. We'd like to see it. I know Dan was talking about possibly funding it.
And it was funny because I'll bring this up, like the comment we got on the Facebook page. You know, the person was saying that he was less likely to fund it now because of this, and I had the exact opposite reaction. I think he even told you before we even saw that. I'm like, yeah, maybe I'll go ahead and get that now.
But one of the things we were talking about the Kickstarter is that like some of the there seems to be kind of a what is called, I guess, a Kickstarter snob is kind of being born from Kickstarter. Yeah,
you're explaining that to me where people are. I'm not only reason I'm giving money is because I get this bonus thing that no one else is going
to
have.
Right. They don't want this thing to be something big that everybody can experience. They want it to be something that they funded and they got this.
And really they're the only ones that got it because they put their money in.
Right, and
well, I can understand
kind of an exclusivity thing.
Yeah. But you know what, Corey? It's like I actually like getting the Kickstarter exclusive. I think they're fun.
Corey's saying that's pretty much what it's becoming for everything.
See, but I think some of what you're talking about is like you kind of see this as like people like.
I was following that band before it was cool. You know, like you get that where it's like, oh, I knew about that game before it hit mainstream.
Right. Yeah, but no, he's saying the only reason I'm going to help that band is if they give me that cool guitar that no one else is going to have. If I don't get that cool guitar, I'm not putting my money in.
I get that CD that's got the three songs that no one
Or I'm not even going to help them.
See,
yeah.
I think you got to get that in all facets of like genre, nerd.
Well, you know, I'm not saying that everybody, that's not what we were saying that everybody on Kickstarter is doing, but he goes, but there's definitely kind of like this
trend.
This trend where there's these Kickstarters that and these people that fund them that won't do it unless they have the right exclusives, and they feel like that if this is not going to go out and anybody will be able to get it, it's like they are getting
they're the only ones going to get it
completely exclusive. And it's
but part of that is like you know a lot of these places are asking you to pony up money with no guarantee about getting your product,
and that sucks.
And I will say I have been extremely lucky. I think I have received everything eventually. You know, it may have taken
a
long time.
I've never done Kickstarter for people that haven't done it either. What is the idea? What is if you do, let's say you do put that money and you never get nothing,
you're out.
It's really? Like, I thought Kickstarter had some kind of thing for.
Nope.
Kickstarter will tell you that it is possible that if you don't come through on whatever you were doing, that you could be subject of lawsuit for fraud or whatever. But that would be, it would take everybody involved in the Kickstarter on a personal level.
Let me
level
put it this way. The only way something like that would happen is if somebody got like $1 million and then like skipped country.
Right.
Like at that point, people would be like,
let's say I do have the best thing. I invented a new wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody sends me all this money and... My production company that couldn't make the new wheel for me couldn't do it. But I have $1 million still. You understand? You know, because it's not because of me, my great idea. It's whatever person was going to build my wheel for me can't do it now. And I'm like, okay, well, I got $1 million. Sorry. It's those guys' fault. I'm out of here.
See, well, then they're like, well, why don't you give us our money?
But I'm saying.
And that's what. Ouya is not giving people money back, but there was some like. Pushback.
What is Ouya?
Ouya is the game console.
Oh, that you got?
Android.
Okay.
Yeah. Ouya is like, they promise a lot of people, like everyone that got their Ouya that ordered on Kickstarter was supposed to get one before it was available in stores.
Right, and you didn't?
Due through snapping shaft, I did.
Oh, okay.
But due through shipping snafus, like I think like a third or so of the people got it actually a few weeks after.
Oh, so the people that went to the store got it before
them. Yeah, they're like, hey, wait a second, I gave you guys this money, you know, like you said I was going to get mine first.
Yeah.
So they are offering those people like $13 in store.
Credit. Wow.
Yeah, $13. Hey, it's better than nothing. But see, that's what I would see in that case. What you're saying is be like, hey, I'm either going to like split up the money evenly that's left back among the backers, or I'm going to do something else to
I didn't know if they had some kind of thing like eBay, you go on there and PayPal, you know.
And in fact, Indiegogo,
and what is that?
Is similar to Kickstarter.
Oh, okay.
But with Kickstarter, if the project does not meet its funding level, no money gets sent.
You know, but the other one, canceled. I was asking Corey about that. Do you get like a portion of it?
Yeah, and Indiegogo, you just get whatever
you send in.
Pledge.
Oh,
so if you're asking for $40,000,
and you only got $30,000,
you get the $30,000, and you continue forward.
Yeah.
See, I think that's in a way it should be that way.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like Corey, you tried a Kickstarter thing, right? And let's say
that would have helped me.
Well, let's say you got $1,000. That would still help you.
That would help me. Yes.
You know, you're asking for how much for yours?
I think five.
$5,000?
Yeah.
If you got $1,000, I'm not saying it would make, you know, but it would help you grease your wheels to be able to move your product along more than just being, you didn't get nothing.
The only thing I'll say about Kickstarter is this. It's like if you're a person out there that's kind of getting that way to where you feel that these people, you know, need to be exclusive, like, the projects that these people come to Kickstarter with are not because they want to make a Kickstarter project. It's not like I'm selling a product for
like Walmart. You're just there's Kickstarter. I've got this. I just thought of to put on Kickstarter.
You're trying to. This person is coming because they don't have the capital to make something come true for themselves. So they're looking for people to help them make a dream come
and that's
true.
Pretty much what this guy was explaining to
them. Exactly. And so you have to understand, these people are not your dancing monkey. they are there because they want to basically take
their photos or their book or their movie. What he's saying is now the mainstream people are stepping in that already are the Dancing Monkey and
Palladium did the
Robotech game.
Okay.
And that was probably a company that had enough money.
Oh, yeah. They could. That's what I guess this guy was trying to explain is they already had it in production. Mm-hmm. They're going to do it anyways. Yep. This money now is just extra money for them to make their product.
I also don't have a problem with that either.
It's
I don't have a problem with any. If you're a big company, like a big gaming company, and you're like, I wonder if Robotech really does
is popular anymore.
A fan base.
Yeah.
And so you do a small Kickstarter to kind of test the waters, and it goes off the chart. You're like, we got to do this game.
Yep.
You know, and
which is great for us as fans. You know, I love Shadowrun.
Yeah,
and Kickstarter did a Shadowrun old timey our computer game from back in the I guess early 90s, and it was based off the Super Nintendo Shadowrun, and I was like, that's a great idea because if it doesn't catch on and no one gives no money, well, I guess Shadowrun is pretty much a dead idea. Don't waste your time.
Well, they blew that out of the water. They had so much stuff coming for
and
that.
Then on the flip side, what Joe said, you know, we talked about this on a podcast a couple of podcasts ago. You know, the new FASA Corporation had that 1874 or whatever that was the steampunky thing. That thing was gone in like 2 weeks. They just canceled it.
Oh, really?
And I think it's because they put it out there and they got
no one wanted horrible. It.
And admittedly, you know, you and I talked at the time that it seemed super ambitious. They didn't seem to have a lot of detail.
Right.
They had a steampunk universe, but it wasn't very.
They didn't tell you nothing about it or nothing.
Fleshed out, and they were going to do a miniatures game, a role play game. And
And
it was just too much.
They were trying to cover too many bases.
So even if you're going to donate your money, you're like, you're making 15 things with my money.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where it's like I think that. You need to basically understand that these people are all artisans. They're all artists, whether they're working with film or books or paintings or pictures or are creating a game or whatever. And these people want your help to get their product out to an audience, and they want to help. They want you that's their way of wanting to make a living or to make their product.
Or at least, or not even that, just to share that cool idea with you. Yeah. You'll never be able to see normally.
You know, and as a consumer or a backer on Kickstarter, it's like it's up to you to decide. You know, for me, it's like the threshold is like if I see a cool project and it's like $10, I'll just give the guy $10 if I never get it. Oh well.
Right.
If I'm spending $75 or $100, I want to have a good feeling about this.
Right.
This thing has a really good probability of happening.
I can understand some people being upset about, you know, this guy's only going to release it for Kickstarter, but I can understand, let's say you're releasing a book.
Right.
How much does it cost to print of one book by itself?
It would cost
you more than you would ever even probably make on if you sold 100 books.
Right.
Does print one book for one person. So as Kickstarter allows you to share that printed idea, you know, not digitally, but printed with everybody else. And I can see this guy with his game is, I would really like to share this with everybody, but the only way we're going to do it is you all have to buy it through Kickstarter.
Yep.
And it makes perfect sense to me. Yep. They just don't have, until you, I think you guys were talking about in one of your other things about the 3D printer, and he could print out all the parts you could order the game. Yep. He prints out one game for you and mails it to you, you know?
Yep.
There was a cool article about that, but we will save that for another.
I saw, I think, that you posted a video on the New York Times about that. So if you want to know about what Dan is going to talk about later, head over to Facebook/Nerdy Times and take a look at some of the videos that we have up on our Facebook page, as well as some of the other articles and arguments and everything else. Mm-hmm. But I think we're going to close that out here. I wanted to thank Brian Wood for Skyping with me and talking to me about Shuriken.
Patience for our crazy.
And hopefully he gets his game released.
Yeah, I hope he gets his game released because it's, you know, I'd love to try it myself just to say I did once.
And like I said, the people that are kind of upset about it, you know, you got to look at it in the other hand of it. So
yeah,
get over it.
Yep.
Well, if not, email Dan. Tell him how you don't like him.
And where would they email Dan?
I don't know. Where at, Dan?
info@nerdytimes.com.
Yep. And if they wanted to find Dan's website that he made so painstakingly with love, you could go to nerdytimes.com and see it. You can go to Nerdy Times at Facebook. It can be Facebook/Nerdy Times. And you can follow us on Twitter
at
nerdytimes.com.
There you go.
That's it for this week's show, everybody. definitely consider supporting Shuriken. I think it would be an interesting
or any game. Other cool game or on
anything else that you find cool on there. And this is Corey, Dan, and Joe telling you to have a great week.
Goodbye. Bye.